Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today on WPR. Diana Alfuth is back with us. She recently retired as a UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. And we're great to have her with us. We're going to start by talking about amending your soil and correct watering methods as well. But, of course, we'll take your other gardening questions, too, as we move along. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Diana Alfuth, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry, it's great to see and hear you again. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you sound pretty enthused, and you're retired since you were last with us. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but what's retirement been like for you?
Well, it's an interesting transition, which is continuing here. You know, I've gotten a lot of advice and insight from people who have gone before me, and it truly is a transition and takes a little while to get used to, but I must admit I'm not missing some of the work requirements of recording and administration and setting the alarm clock. So it's kind of nice so far.
All right. Well, are you? Well, let me put it this way: how are you spending your time?
Well, it's interesting. So I have horses, so I'm trying to spend some time with them. It's been such an unusual winter, so I had kind of expected to be, as usual, kind of hibernating and doing indoor things like crafting, and of course, whatever newly retired person expects to do, cleaning out that closet and that storeroom and stuff, none of which has gotten done this winter because it's been so nice out. And I'm looking forward to a gardening season because when working, you don't have that much time to really spend attention to it. So my vegetable gardens and stuff have been kind of bare bones, just the basics the last few years. And so we're looking at redoing the fence around the garden and kind of expanding and spending a little bit more attention to my own gardens this year as the season starts.
Do you have a favorite story or two about your time, your work?
Oh, gosh. You know, being a local county extension person it has been wonderful because there's so much variety, and you really get to share people's successes and interests and help them along the way. But I admit that when I first got the job, I wasn't exactly sure what it was and what it would entail. And of course, you come out of college with your horticulture degrees in hand, and you know all the basics, and you have all that foundation stuff that you draw on every day in this job. But my first day in the office, I walked into the St. Croix County office and I picked up a voicemail. And the first question I got was a gentleman who just left a message and said, "How much salt should I put on my asparagus?" and I was really taken aback because I thought that was, you know, a cooking question more than anything, because I had, you know, but the great thing about this job is just that you get these questions and you don't know the answer, but you go searching for the answer and you learn about the various things. And so as much as I learned in college at the University of Minnesota and my bachelor's and master's degrees, I learned way more on this job with questions like that. And what I found out about the salt and asparagus was that putting salt on an asparagus bed is a, quote, old time method of controlling weeds in asparagus. But what I also found out then, in the reason I never learned about doing that in college, is because it's really not recommended. And the reason that it it does kind of work, because if you get salt at a high enough level, plants die. Plants don't like really salty soils. But asparagus has a higher tolerance for salt than a lot of other weeds do. And so the idea is you put salt on the asparagus bed, it kills off the weeds, but not the asparagus. But the reality is that it may not kill your asparagus, but it really stresses it and it really lowers your production and is really not the best way to control weeds in your asparagus bed. But that was, I remember clearly my first question, and, there have been doozies over the years.
Okay. Well, you mentioned weeds, and Todd in De Pere has a question that kind of relates to weeds. So let's go there. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about composting. I started a small compost pile. And my wife's a very good weed puller, but she had put the weeds on that compost pile. Now, I have access to green horse manure. If I was to mix that in with that pile and maybe put black plastic over it, would it get hot enough to kill those weed seeds?
Probably. So you're right. I mean, ideally you pull weeds before they go to seed, or at least before the seeds mature, and then you throw them on your compost pile, and it's a great way to recycle those nutrients. If you've got weed seeds that are in there, if the temperature gets up high enough, it will kill those weed seeds. So if you're the, just a lazy composter, you just throw everything on the pile and it'll heat up in the middle, but not on the edges. So you have to turn that pile. If you actively compost, your pile will get up to 140, 145 degrees in the middle, and that kills most weed seeds. So just turning that pile actively is usually enough. Now, if you've got a pile that's kind of old and dry, you know, I'm assuming these weeds were put there last year because they haven't really been growing and going to seed yet this year. And you want to kickstart that pile to heat it up, then anything that's somewhat higher in nitrogen will do that. Okay, so composting is kind of a little bit of a science between carbon and nitrogen to get things heated up in there. So fresh horse manure definitely would do it. Fresh manure of any kind would do it. Anything green would do it. So like the grass hasn't started growing yet, but once you start getting grass growing, if you collected grass clippings from your first mowing and put those in there and stirred that around, that would heat it up in the middle. And then once you get that extra nitrogen and green stuff in there, if you stir it like once a week or so, so that you get everything into the heated center of the pile, you can kill off most of those weed seeds. And I really wouldn't worry about them too much then. But the key is to get it heated up. And you can get compost thermometers. They look like 18-inch long meat thermometers. And you can put that into the middle of the pile and monitor it. If you build a compost pile with greens and browns, basically, it will heat up within 2 days, up to 140 degrees. So it doesn't take a lot to get that heat in there. And then as you stir it and as that high nitrogen green stuff depletes, then the pile won't heat up as much. But your compost pile is not lost. You can definitely get it heated up and not worry about those weed seeds.
All right, Todd. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And I think that was probably a lot of good information for others around the state who have their own compost piles. And so some good information there. One of the things we wanted to talk about today was soil amendments. And what are we doing wrong?
Well,
salt was the good example, I guess.
Yeah, salt has no place in the soil. But one of the things, you know, over the 22 years with Extension that comes up over and over and over, and I also kind of lurk on these statewide Facebook group groups, Wisconsin Gardeners and stuff like that, where there's a lot of great information that goes on. But one of the things that is frustrating as a horticulturist is seeing micromanaging of soil. So what I really, you know, the message I really try to get to people is we live in Wisconsin. Okay, I know not all the listeners on right now are in Wisconsin, but in Wisconsin, we are a big agricultural state for a reason. And that reason is because we naturally have very fertile soils. Okay. So we got to keep that in mind. This is not, you know, Wyoming or, you know, places where the soil is not fertile and doesn't grow much other than sagebrush. We have super fertile soils. So we don't need to be micromanaging them. And what I mean by that is, if you're growing in ground in Wisconsin, your soil is likely going to grow your plants, at least the basics. Okay. Plants have, there's 17 or 18 essential plant nutrients that every plant needs to grow. If any one of those nutrients is missing, the plant won't grow at all. But every plant that grows has taken up all of those nutrients. So getting back to the caller and the compost pile, that's great that they're composting because you're recycling those nutrients when you compost. So if those weeds that grew in their garden went on the compost pile, when they're composted down and added back to the garden, they're adding every one of those essential plant nutrients. Okay. And because they would not have grown. So I always say, you know, if you've got a healthy crop of weeds growing in your garden, you have all of the nutrients you need. So what we see a lot of are people suggesting adding eggshells to the garden, adding coffee grounds to the garden. One of the recent ones is to take your banana peels and put them in a jug of water on your kitchen counter and let them rot for a couple of days and then run them through the mixer. And it's a great source of potassium. And that all may be true, but the question is, does your soil really need any of those nutrients? Probably not. If you add a couple inches of compost to your vegetable garden every year, you have added every nutrient your plants need. And there is nothing magical about coffee grounds. There's nothing magical about eggshells. You know, that the eggshell one comes into play mainly with tomatoes and blossom end rot.
Yeah, calcium, supposedly.
Right. But the problem is that in Wisconsin, your soil most likely has more than enough calcium because it's in the limestone that made the soil. If your pH, if your soil pH is 6 or above, you do not have a calcium deficiency. And adding more calcium to your soil will do nothing because the plants are only going to take up what they want and what they need. You don't see farmers dumping calcium on the soils to grow the crops, right? We have enough calcium. If you're on a sandy outwash area that has a low soil pH, you know, below 6 or in the 5s or something, then it's true you might have a calcium deficiency, but you have a pH that's too low to grow your plants. So you need to add lime to get the pH up. That's your main concern. And lime has calcium in it. So you would get your calcium levels back up there. So adding eggshells or Tums when you're planting your tomatoes is not going to affect whether or not you get blossom end rot because it's true that blossom end rot on your tomatoes is because of a lack of calcium getting to that developing fruit. However, that's not because there's not enough calcium in the soil. It's because there's something interfering with the calcium getting up there. And I know there are listeners out there right now saying, no, ever since I started adding eggshells or putting an antacid tablet in the bottom of my hole, I haven't had blossom end rot. But chances are you're also, if you're that attentive of a gardener, you're probably also watering correctly. And the water coming up through the plant is where the calcium gets up to the plant. And I will tell you, I've never added either of those, and I never have blossom end rot either. So if you're really concerned that you have a calcium deficiency, get it tested, and then you'll know. Tomatoes don't actually need more calcium than any other plant. They just have a harder time getting it to the developing fruit. And the other problem is, often people say, well, if it doesn't hurt, then why not? You know, just to be sure. But it can hurt. And that's one thing that is kind of difficult to measure. But this is all chemistry. There's a whole lot of chemistry stuff going on down in the soil. And if you add too much calcium, if you get too much calcium in your soil, you can actually interfere with your plant's abilities to take up other nutrients like magnesium and iron and some of the other nutrients, because if there's too much of one thing, it gets in the way of others. So, and it's the same with Epsom salts. Epsom salts is nothing but magnesium and sulfur. Okay. If you had a deficiency of either in your soil, then yes, it would be a good fertilizer. But chances are you don't have a deficiency, not in Wisconsin. And if you add too much magnesium, it can actually interfere with the uptake of calcium and cause the blossom end rot. So stop micromanaging the soils. Just add compost.
So put Tums in your tummy and not in your tomatoes.
And soak your feet in the Epsom salts. Don't put it on your garden.
Diana Alfuth, our guest today, retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. You can join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau's our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Alfuth, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Great to have her with us today. Join in, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Debbie emailed that she has several hydrangeas in several places. They grow huge, beautiful plants, but they don't bloom. What's up?
Oh, dear. Well, that's a little bit tricky to answer because there are a couple different kinds of hydrangeas. And there are, did she say where she's located?
No.
Okay. So there are, for example, the Endless Summer series of hydrangeas, they very often don't bloom in the northern part of the state, and often not even in the southern part of the state, because they bloom on new wood that takes a long time to get growing. So I guess, you know, the answer is first we have to know what kind of hydrangeas she has, and then also, is she pruning those hydrangeas? Because if she's pruning them back, she might be pruning off the place where the blossoms are going to be. So there are some hydrangeas that basically die back to the ground every year and you prune away all the dead stuff. And there are others that bloom on old wood or stuff that still was. So if you're pruning that away, it's kind of like, you know, lilacs. If you bloom lilacs over winter, you bloom away the bloom, you prune away the blooms and stuff. So first, we'd have to know exactly which kinds of hydrangeas, and then if there's a pruning issue going on. The other question is just light. So there are some varieties like Annabelle, the old Annabelle tried and true, that can really be happy in shade, in pretty dark shade. But there are some hydrangeas that really need sunlight in order to bloom and bloom well. So it could be any combination of stuff going on there. And so if she has been pruning, I would suggest not pruning for a couple of years and see if that helps. And then otherwise, you know, if there's any way to figure out exactly what kind of hydrangea she has to see if it's getting the right amount of light.
There we go. Let's take a call from Bruce in Dover. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Larry, my favorite guy. I'm so happy with your guest today. She called tomatoes a fruit, and I love to hear that because to me, tomatoes are prairie oranges out here on the tundra. Hey, I have a question. I might be feeble, I might be senile, but I am not having any luck with portulaca. When I was young, I could make them grow, and I've been testing my soil pH and just any pointers I could receive on prompting my portulaca to get going.
Portulaca, lavender?
And lavender. Lavender I've had worse luck with than portulaca.
Oh.
Lavender from seeds and portulaca from seeds.
Okay.
So, you said you grew it a lot in the past and you were successful with that, but now you're not?
No, I just, when I was a child, they just grew in my hand. My thumb was so green, you know. Maybe I'm getting bad seeds. I don't know.
Well, if the seeds germinate, then it's not that the seeds are bad. So that shouldn't be an issue. So do they like just die off or do they just grow weak or?
They don't make it. What I've done to germinate the seeds is I take distilled water and I freeze it. And then I use the frozen meltwater to moisturize the seeds, and they just don't germinate. So it's probably bad seeds. I probably need to go get some real seeds.
Well, if they're not germinating, then yes, there's very possibly a seed issue. But are you buying the seeds from a nursery or a?
No, I'm buying the generic packet like Ferry Morris and what have you.
Yeah, they should still be good seeds because they have to do germination tests on anything that they sell and to make sure that the seed is viable and that. I'm not exactly sure the freezing the distilled water thing. I don't think that's necessarily any benefit to doing that. So the thing is that portulaca seeds do take a long time to germinate. They can take up to 3 weeks to germinate. And in that time, they have to stay moist. So the best thing to do would be to sprinkle them over the top of your soil mix. Don't cover them because they actually need light to germinate. And so don't cover them, but put a little dome over them to keep the humidity in so that they don't dry out. And then you want to put them in a warm place. Okay. So my mom always used to put her seed starts on the top of the refrigerator because the refrigerator gives off enough heat. Mm-hmm. But if you have a heat mat or a heated floor or something, or just a warm room, they do need to stay warm. The faster, the warmer, you know, they'll germinate faster in warm conditions than cool conditions.
And then he's putting ice cubes in there.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about, he was saying he used the melted ice water for germinating. That I don't think does any benefits. So just use basic water. Okay, your water should be fine. And then put that tray in a warm location, not in the sun because you don't want it to get too hot down there. And ideally something like 70 to 75 degrees. And then wait. Again, you got to kind of be patient because it can take up to 3 weeks for these things to germinate. Peek at them every couple of days. Make sure the surface of the soil isn't drying out, but you don't want it, you know, soaking wet either. If it looks like it's getting dry, and it shouldn't if it's covered with plastic, but if it looks like it's getting dry, open it up and mist the seeds a little bit. And then, and see if you get better luck that way. Once they germinate, then you want to take that that humidity dome off. So take the plastic off and get them out into some good sunlight and stuff. But if germination is the problem, try it that way. And like I said, don't bury the seeds, because there are some seeds that need light to germinate, and this is one of them.
Yeah. What about lavender? We can grow lavender in a lot of places here in Wisconsin. I think there's at least 13 or so lavender farms in the state.
Yeah, that has really changed, because 20 years ago, lavender in Wisconsin, no way, at least not in the northern part. And mainly it was out in the Door County area and stuff, where the lake effect keeps, you know, the weather a little warmer. But there are some new varieties out that are a little hardier, and we have this thing called climate change going on where our winters just aren't getting as cold. So lavender is one that's not really hard to grow from seed. And again, the same method that I just explained. I'm not 100% sure if lavender needs light or not to germinate, or whether it should be, if the seed should be slightly buried. I'd have to look that up. But the key with any seed starting is, once you get those seeds wet, is keeping them moist until they germinate. And that's what the purpose of the plastic or the humidity dome kind of a thing is. It keeps the soil and the seeds from drying out until they germinate. And then depending on how much lavender you want, it's pretty readily available in greenhouses now in spring. So if you just want a few plants, you can buy started plants already and let the professionals at the greenhouse do all the germinating.
There you go. Bruce, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate hearing your voice. Let's go to Jim in River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thank you for the program today. I was wondering, I just burned a small section of my front yard's prairie, and it's the never-ending task of trying to keep wild raspberries out of there. And I know fall would be a better time to apply like systemic herbicide to each individual plant, but I'm just wondering, triclopyr, Garlon 4, I've got 30% concentrated Roundup, what's the best way? I could keep them cut down, I guess, this summer, although that would be hard without, cutting down some of the other prairie plants, keep them mowed down. But I just want to get, and I started pulling some, but then, of course, the roots break off. So I was just wondering what might be the best springtime or in summer method of trying to get these raspberries killed out in the prairie.
Okay.
I feel your pain, because I have prairie and I've got the same darn problem. Those brambles get in there and they are hard to get rid of. And you're right, frequent mowing could finally exhaust the energy out of the roots and really knock them back. And yes, fall is usually the best time for using systemic herbicides. But if you burned it now, what I might suggest is that you have your little tank of triclopyr. Is great for it. Triclopyr is the recommended active ingredient for woody stuff, which this is. And as you mentioned, these spread by underground roots. And so just pulling them is really not always effective, because those root sections will resprout. But if you've burned it now, I would have your tank of your triclopyr mixed according to the label instructions. And when things start greening up and you walk out there and you start seeing little leaves off of these raspberry shoots, just spot spray them. Just get it on the leaves. It'll go down into the roots and kill off the roots. And it's going to be a thing where, you're going to have to keep up on it. But, a little evening stroll, and you do some here, some there, and to keep them from growing up and doing all the photosynthesis and restoring those root systems. But I think with the size of space that you have, usually these things are in clumps or patches, you can really knock them back that way. So the triclopyr will still be effective even not in fall, especially when these plants are they use a lot of energy. They've used energy making it through winter. They're going to be using energy every time they grow. And so if you can zap them when they're young, you can probably get them mostly under control that way. That would be my recommendation.
Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mark emailed, grass wasn't growing under his large white spruce tree until he started adding a little lime under it every year. Usually put a little on the rest of the lawn as well. Can he be adding too much to his lawn?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So all lime does is raise your soil pH. And if your soil pH gets too high, things won't grow. So pH is important because it affects a plant. It affects the plant's ability to take up nutrients out of the soil. So for example, if your pH is too high, it's really hard for plants to take iron out of the soil. And there may be more than enough iron in the soil. So dumping more iron on the soil isn't going to help because the plants can't take it up until you lower the pH. So I do not recommend adding lime unless you have a soil test done by a lab, not the little test tube over the counter things, because I don't know that those are always accurate, but send a soil test into the lab and see what your pH is. If it's already like 7, you don't want to be adding lime because you can start getting your pH too high. So check your pH before you add lime. Under a white spruce, there's a little bit of a misconception that that evergreens like spruce and pines lower the pH of the soil. And that's not really true, other than maybe like on the top inch of the soil where the needles are decomposing. It really doesn't alter the soil pH down where, you know, like if you were to plant hostas in there or something, where the root zone of those plants are. So I'm wondering if it wasn't only that the lime had an effect, but if some branches got pruned up and so there's more light, because usually grass doesn't grow under pine trees because it's too dark, because it's so shaded, and or because the needles that do fall basically smother the grass. So if you just keep those needles raked out of there, or if you somehow get more light in there, you can very often get grass growing in there. The other thing is that spruce and pine trees and stuff, they have very fibrous root systems, and trees are much better at taking the soil moisture out than the grass. And so that competition can keep your grass from growing. And then I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here, but very often when people clear up under a tree or something like this and plant new grass seed, it grows up really nice and the grass is growing, but it doesn't last because the conditions aren't favorable. If it's too dark, if it's going to get smothered, that grass is going to slowly decline out over the next couple years. Yeah, might not be a place for grass.
Megan in Black Creek emailed that given our dry summers, what's the best way to hand water vegetables and perennial gardens? She often hears to water deep and less often versus shallow and often. But is there a way to know if we are watering effectively with minimum waste?
That is a great question and a long answer. It's true that when we're having these droughts, so last year was really dry all throughout the state. And one of the unfortunate things that I saw on social media and stuff was people saying, oh, they were out there watering their garden twice a day. There is no way you need to water your garden twice a day, even in 95 degree summers and stuff, because while this very surface of the soil may dry out, 6 inches down where the roots are, there's no way that soil dries out in a day or so. So there was a lot of overwatering going on. And what happens, and I have seen this multiple times, is people say, yeah, but by the middle of the afternoon, my plants are wilting. Well, that's because you've been overwatering. You've got a very small root system because those roots haven't grown out into the soil. If you're overwatering, you might have a little bit of root rot and root diseases going in and there that has those root systems very small. So then by the heat of the afternoon, the plants are evaporating out more water than that tiny root system is able to take up. And so, yes, they wilt. And but you should not be watering that much. So the emailer is absolutely right. You should water deeply less often. If you're on a clay soil and we're not getting rain, the general rule is that most plants need an inch of water a week. And for vegetables, maybe an inch and a half because we want juicy tomatoes, right? But on a clay soil, you should split that maybe into two waterings and water at least a half an inch at a time. So maybe like on Sunday and Thursday if we don't get any rain. If you're on a sandy soil, you might up that to an inch and a half, again, twice a week, maybe three times a week. But ideally, we are watering the soil and not the leaves, okay? Because any kind of overhead watering, you lose a lot of water to evaporation. And that's not good water conservation. We need to be concerned about that. So a soaker hose, there's all kinds of drip irrigation systems and stuff that you can set up. And you can wind them in between your perennials. Perennials, by the way, they need an inch of water a week, but they have a deeper and more extensive root system than vegetables that are annuals. So they need even less water. I will tell you that with all the drought last year, I didn't water my perennials at all, and they're just fine. And it kind of goes back to what we mentioned earlier about micromanaging your soil. Over-attentiveness and over-watering causes more problems than underwatering. A mature tree, shrub, or perennial with an established root system can easily go a few weeks with no water. But when you do water, water so that you're getting a good inch of soil on, or inch of water on the soil at a time. With an overhead sprinkler system, you know, you could put up a little rain gauge or cans or buckets out there and measure how long it takes for you to get an inch of water on the soil. But we don't really want to overhead water. So with a drip irrigation system, what you should do is turn it on, let it run for a couple of hours, and then you need to kind of go out there and dig down and see how deep it is. Once the water is 3 inches deep in the soil, after having oozed out of your soaker hose, that's enough. It'll continue to go down with that, and that's probably about an inch. The key, though, is don't water unless your plants need it. So your best measurement is your finger. So go out there, go under any mulch that you have, and stick your finger down in the soil. If it's moist, an inch down in the soil, you don't need to water. If it's getting dry an inch down, that's the time to water. So we don't know what this summer is going to bring, if it's going to be as hot and dry as next year. You know, right now we're in a drought and things are not looking good statewide. But that can change quickly. Don't water on a regular schedule. Water only when you need it. And again, you probably shouldn't need in any condition to water more than twice a week. Maybe three times a week if you're on sugar sand. And but again, doing things like mulching to help preserve the soil moisture is super, super important and useful. Overwatering is more likely going to cause diseases. And that'll make Dr. Brian Huddleston in the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic really happy to have root rots and foliar fungal diseases sent to him.
And just one final thing, if you are putting the hose on for 2 hours, don't forget to turn it off.
I did once. That's a great thing. So if you've got your phone or a watch or something like that, put an alarm on it and tell you.
Yeah, don't let it run all afternoon and then all night.
I've done that too, Larry, and I'm sure we're not alone.
Our guest today, Diana Alfoth, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. She's was a specialist for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Alfuth, retired UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. Questions? Give a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. We'll get you on pretty quickly when you call in. Lori in central Wisconsin emailed to say she had a question. Oops, my screen jumped, so I got to get back to it. She has compost. She says compost, hey, it's comprised of vegetable scraps, browns, greens, eggshells, manure, straw. As it breaks down, it heats up. Why not just add it right to the soil?
Oh, that's a great question. So when you have fresh stuff in the compost pile like that and it hits the soil, the breaking down that we talk about is done by microbes. There's a gazillion different kinds of microbes in that soil, and they use that as a feed source. So they eat that stuff that you've thrown on your pile, and then just like our bodies give off heat, when they eat that stuff, they reproduce. So the number of microbes jumps, and the heat is actually caused by those microbes. It's the respiration of their little microbe bodies and stuff. And so, but they need all these other nutrients and stuff too, including nitrogen. So the challenge is that you can often, if you added it right to your soil and it decomposes in the soil, the microbes will do that, but they will also take nitrogen out of the soil, which would probably starve your plants of some of that nitrogen. Now, that's not a problem there are things called like trench composting, where basically you might like dig a trench along the edge of your garden and you throw all your waste in there, your vegetable waste and everything throughout the year. And then you just bury that up and it decomposes under the soil, you know, over the next year. By the next year, you can just kind of mess that all around and plant into it, and it's not a problem anymore. So, you know, a good rule of thumb is if you can still recognize what it once was, it's probably not composted enough. But once something is not really recognizable, it's decomposed down enough that it's probably not going to suck nitrogen out of the soil. And so if you had a fallow part of your garden and you just threw everything on that part and kind of worked it into the soil, it's going to decompose. Okay. And it's just, you know, we got to remember, kind of gets back to micromanaging and stuff. Look out your window and, you know, to the nearest woodlands and stuff like that. Nobody's adding coffee grounds or eggshells or banana peels or anything to that. It's just the leaves fall, the nutrients are released as they compost, basically, and they get taken back up by the roots. And, you know, those same little molecules of those nutrients go through a tree multiple times. So it's a similar kind of thing, but it's just you don't want to put any kind of fresh stuff to break down near your growing plants, because it could suck out the nitrogen and then your plants can have a nitrogen deficiency.
Anthony in Watertown, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm trying to help my wife out and surprise her, because this is the part where we start to prepare her garden. And I know nothing about gardening other than I do what I am told by her. Now, when I'm trying to help, I don't want to set everything back. And I'm looking for a way to cover. She's a fruit vegetable gardener, not flower gardener. And I understand Mother Nature hates bare earth. That's why it covers it with weeds when given the opportunity. I need to know, do I put wood chips down? Do I put mulch over? Do I put a black netting and then stuff to help keep the moisture in the garden for her?
Okay, so you're talking about areas that are not going to be planted this year, like on the edges, or until things get planted?
I have a two-strip garden. It's about, each strip is about, I want to say, 4 foot wide by 12 feet long. Not a lot of gardening. She puts in 3 tomato plants, a few ears of corn, tries to grow lettuce and carrots on one side, stuff like that. And she gets really disheartened because of the amount of the weeds that are constantly taking over. So I had looked into it, and I had heard that you put like wood chips, or you put something down and around so that the weeds are covered so they don't grow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Bare earth is bad in a garden.
Right.
Right.
You are absolutely right. Bare soil is not a good thing because, as you say, nature doesn't like it. And a dandelion weed seed can see bare soil from miles away and just floats right in. And there are other problems with bare soil. The raindrops hit it, it splashes, you get erosion, you lose moisture faster. The UV rays hitting the soil break down the organic matter in the soil, and organic matter is good. So we don't want bare soil. So here's my suggestion. In a vegetable garden setting, you should, ideally add compost every year and just kind of work it into the surface of the soil a little bit. That's going to add organic matter and all the nutrients other than maybe a little extra nitrogen is probably the only fertilizer you're going to need if you add compost. But once things are planted, covering that soil. Now, wood chips in a vegetable garden are a little too coarse, and they're going to take a couple years to break down. And as I was just talking about, especially at first, they might draw nitrogen out of the soil. So in the tomato part where she's planting transplants like tomatoes or maybe peppers or, you know, the individual plant kinds of things, as soon as the tomatoes get planted, my suggestion would be to put down some kind of a organic weed barrier. Now that can be a layer of like 6 to 8 sheets of newspaper. It can be some basic brown corrugated cardboard, something like that. What that's going to do is any weed seeds that are in the soil, and there are gazillions of them, no matter what, it will stop those from sprouting. So you won't ever have to pull them. Okay. And then on top of that cardboard or paper, put some kind of organic mulch, and that can be straw. It can be last year's leaves that you saved and collected. It could be dried grass clippings, anything like that. And that basically put about 4 inches on top to hold that cardboard or paper down. And then you never have any weeds to pull except the few that sprout right around the stems of the plants. The other beauty about that is it keeps the soil from splashing up, and you really, really reduce your incidence of tomato blight on tomatoes and stuff. And you can do that between your rows of lettuce, between your rows of beans. Any kind of bare soil, covering it in that fashion is the best thing. So then by the end of the year, that paper or cardboard and mulch is going to be pretty much rotting away and stuff. But because paper is, and newspaper, they use soy ink, so it's considered organic, that will just be decomposing. It can be worked into the soil, and it's considered organic matter. And then you do that each year, and you can super, super reduce your need to weed. And you are absolutely right. Every gardener gets frustrated by the weeds, and anything you can do to prevent them so you don't have to pull them is the way to go. And that mulch, as was mentioned, is also going to hold moisture and reduce your watering. And if you put a soaker hose underneath that cardboard when you plant and underneath that mulch so that you can just connect your hose to the end of the soaker hose and do your watering, it really reduces the maintenance of a garden tremendously.
That is really good advice. And you know, the weeds, they come up just when you're almost getting ready to really harvest or halfway through the summer, and you're looking at them and you say, I'm giving up.
And you know, about the beginning of July in my area, so I'm in West Central part, okay, it seems like it's always like the first and second week of July, those weeds grow 6 inches overnight. I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating. And it's usually at a time when, like, maybe you're gone on vacation for a week and you come back and they're 3 feet high, or, you know, you get busy for some other reason, or it gets 90 degrees and humid and you really don't want to be out there. And then it's just overwhelming. And then when you pull them, you disrupt the roots of your vegetable plants and all of it. It's a mess. So, yes, prevention is so much better.
Indeed. Diana Alfeth is our guest today. Diana is retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County, and she hasn't forgotten anything since she retired. We can tell that for sure. Dunham doing a wonderful job here on Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. Listening to Garden Talk on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Diana Alfeth. She is a retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County, and great to have her back. Our lines are all filled and we've got lots of emails, so let's go to the phones and to Richard in Two Rivers. Richard, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hey, Larry, thanks for having me on. It's I'm at Menards. I work here. You want me to pick you up something at a 10% employee discount? I'll be happy to do it. No, the question I've got, kind of a couple questions. A couple of years back, I have a clawfoot bathtub, put it in the backyard, put rocks on the bottom of it and like a sandy soil on top. So it's got drainage through the drain hole, I guess. And I put lavender in there, and it did really good for the first year, and then I didn't come up the next after winter. And I wanted to ask, was it Diana? I want to ask her, what can I do? Should I cover it with wood or something in the wintertime, or just what should I do to make it, you know, come up every year and flourish?
Okay.
Yeah. So basically what you're doing is that bathtub is a big container, and it's very often difficult to get perennial plants to make it through winter in Wisconsin in containers, because if you plant that lavender in the ground, the soil freezes. Okay. But normally our soil freezes only down to about 27 or 28 degrees. Okay. In winters where we don't have snow cover and we get really, really cold weather, that soil can freeze down to like 20 degrees, and that's when we have plants die off. When you grow in a container, including even though your tub is pretty big, the soil freezes to a colder temperature because it freezes from the sides, not just the top. So in the ground, you know, it freezes from the top, but there's, you know, obviously heat in the center of the earth, so it's always giving off warmth. So that's what keeps the soil from freezing so cold. But in any kind of a container, it freezes from the side. So your soil in your tub might be freezing down to 20 degrees or so. Now, this last winter, probably not, right? Because it wasn't that cold, but in a normal winter. And that cold soil, then it freezes and kills the roots of the plant. So normally, if you know, if someone wants to grow perennial plants in, that's usually why we usually only put annuals in containers. But if you want to grow perennials in there, you usually do have to do some kind of winter protection to keep that soil from freezing so cold. So, you know, if it's a small enough container, people might move them into a unheated shed or garage or something where it doesn't get as cold, or you can pack stuff around them. So sometimes people will use like straw bales or something and pack it around the sides of the container and, you know, to keep it from freezing from the sides so cold, getting, you know, from the cold air and that. And lavender is a kind of borderline plant in a lot of Wisconsin to begin with. It likes warm temperatures, and so that's probably what happened, is it just froze too cold in there. So trying to figure out some kind of way to keep that soil mass that's in the tub from getting as cold is what you would have to do, or you just plant annuals.
There you go, Richard. Thanks so much. Find yourself some bales of hay maybe, or straw bales, and otherwise take Diana's advice on not planting perennials in there.
And Larry, I know you're a straw bale gardener, so that would be a great way to get your straw bales in the fall and insulate your bathtub in the winter and then use them to plant in the spring.
That's a really good idea. Richard, thank you for calling. Mary Ann in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi. I live in Waukesha, and our city water used to have chlorine to purify it, and now they're changing to chloramine, and chloramine does not evaporate out of the water. So I was wondering if you know if that would build up in the soil and it wouldn't make any difference in watering plants outside or houseplants.
That's a great question, and I do not know the difference between chloramine and chlorine and city water. So I'm not likely going to be able to give you great advice there. But typically in the soil, like in your in-ground garden, getting back to all those microbes that are in there, most of the time they disperse stuff. So chlorine in an in-ground garden is usually, you know, I've never seen it be a problem. It can be a problem in houseplants, as you mentioned. And so, you know, the best solution is to collect rainwater or, you know, melt snow or purchase water or get water from a friend who's got a well or something like that for watering houseplants. I doubt it will be a problem in your outdoor stuff. But again, I'm just not familiar with chloramine, and I don't know how it interacts versus chlorine.
Yeah, it hangs around. I mean, you can't just let it sit. Even if you let it sit, it won't
evaporate out like chlorine and some of the other things will do. Okay, yeah.
We'll have to look that up.
Right. That might be a question more for, you know, a city water expert.
Yeah. I've got Doug Soldat coming on in a month, but to talk about, and he's our lawn guy, but he's also knows a lot about water, too, and soil. So.
Yeah, and soil. Yeah. Doug would maybe have the answers.
We'll try to find something out, and even next Garden Talk, if we can. Next week, we'll try and come up with an answer. Jill, chloramine, look that up. Or let's see what we can find out. Take another call here. Jody in Brooklyn, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Jody.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about black-eyed Susans. I purchased a handful of plants last year, put them in, and about halfway through the summer, they had mildew on them, some of them. And I got conflicting information when I looked it up between cutting them down, pulling them out, using a spray on them. I'm not sure what the correct answer is, so I'm asking you.
Okay. So when you say mildew, I'm assuming you mean the leaves were kind of white and kind of...
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. So that's powdery mildew. Powdery mildew is very, very common. It affects a lot of different plants. It's actually, so you can get it on lilacs and bee balm and black-eyed Susans and even grass, but each one is actually very plant specific. They're slightly different mildews that affect different plants. So it doesn't spread from one plant species to another. But what it tells you when you have it on multiple plants is that the conditions are right. And what powdery mildew is, a fungus, and normally most fungi like wet leaves to take hold and then they cause leaf spots. Powdery mildews are different in that they don't actually like wet leaves. They like it when we get hot and humid conditions. And of course, last year especially was terrible for it. So lots and lots of powdery mildews around. The thing is that powdery mildews rarely kill a plant. About the only time that they kill plants are when they get on like squash and cucumbers. If it gets bad enough and it blocks the leaves' ability to do photosynthesis and stuff. But on perennial plants, they don't kill the plants. It just makes the foliage look ugly because it just grows on the surface of the foliage. So once the fuzziness or the white stuff is on the leaves, there's really nothing you can do about it. I mean, you can wash that off, and we see different recommendations like milk and stuff, and that doesn't actually kill the fungus. It might wash the white fuzz off so it looks like it cured it, but it really didn't. So we know that we're going to get hot, humid weather in Wisconsin in summer. Powdery mildew is going to be a problem every year, some years like last year, worse than others. If you want to prevent it, you have to prevent it. So before you start seeing any kind of white stuff, if you, you know, ideally we say, well, just don't plant susceptible plants so that you don't get it. But if you have plants that you really like and you don't want to get rid of and you don't want them to have powdery mildew, then you need to put a fungicide on before the conditions get right for it. Okay. So by mid-July in Wisconsin, we've got hot, humid weather, and that's when we start seeing the powdery mildew, but those infections actually occurred a couple of weeks before that. So if you have a plant that's super susceptible to it, you need to treat it with a fungicide before it starts showing up. There are, you know, a variety of fungicides out at the garden centers and stuff that you can use. Just read the label, make sure that it's labeled for powdery mildew. There is a baking soda concoction. And if you go to the disease diagnostic clinics, Dr. Brian Hendelson has this on there somewhere, but it's like a tablespoon or two of baking soda, a tablespoon of a horticultural oil. In a pinch, you can use canola oil and water and a couple drops of like a dish soap in there that makes it stick. The key is you've got to have that oil component in there. So the research has shown that if you just have baking soda and soap and water, it's not that effective. You've got to have that oil component in there. And you spray that, you got to cover the leaves and probably every, you know, 7 to 10 days or so, starting early before you start seeing the powdery mildew. And that should prevent it from showing up at least most of it and lessen it. So if you have a susceptible plant in our humid summers in Wisconsin, you're most likely going to have powdery mildew. But again, it rarely kills a plant. It's more of a cosmetic thing that's just ugly to us, bothers us more than it bothers the plant.
There you go, Jody. Thanks so much for calling. And while you were talking, I did a quick look online. To remove chloramine from the water, you can have a charcoal or carbon filter at the point of exit, you know, at the point of use. And that is effective in eliminating it from the water, according to at least what I've been able to find here online. So just wanted to mention that. Georgia in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. Hey, when I live in Madison now, but I lived in Door County for a number of years and had a fairly big garden. And my well had lots of iron and sulfur in it. And the plants didn't like it. It would kill my house plants. And if I sprinkled with it, it would turn everything orange. So I heard about this weeping irrigation system. I found it in a place in Canada where they use Tyvek tubing, and I set up a stock tank that collected water off the roof, and so I was watering with rainwater as much as I could. Sometimes I had to fill the tank with well water. But that really worked well. And, I only know one other person who's done that, and I'm kind of surprised that that system never caught on. I'm wondering if your guest has any,
information on it.
That's a great example of figuring out the problem that you have, right, and a solution to it. And that's the great thing about gardening, and one of the things that I've really enjoyed over my years with Extension is hearing about things like this that people have used their ingenuity and come up with. So if, you know, the thing is that most people across Wisconsin don't have a horrible iron problem. And again, one of the things that is so wonderful about Wisconsin is, for the most part, we have fabulous water, right? Plentiful water and high quality water and all that. But there are places, as you mentioned, that have high iron or some other kinds of things. And then we have the city water issues that we just talked about. So looking at your situation and how to deal with it, there may be lots of solutions you can set up. One of the things, though, is that with climate change, we are getting more and more concerned about preserving our water and protecting our water, because we're going to be having more extremes of droughts and floods and all that sort of a thing. So there is more interest in people setting up water storage things. You know, rain barrels have been around for a long time, but people are looking at doing things on a larger scale, and stock tanks might be a great option for that, because for watering outdoor plants, it doesn't need to be, you know, water that you can drink. So I see a lot of things out there where people are getting creative and building options for them to collect water for watering their yards and gardens. And I think that's a great reminder that we really should be looking into that.
Thank you, Georgia. Appreciate that call and that information. Deb in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Deb.
Hi. This has a question to do with straw bale gardening, and I'm interested in starting that this summer. And I am having a hard time finding a source for straw bales in the Madison area. I can find the small ones, but they're so expensive. I'm wondering if you or any of the listeners or someone has some recommendations of where I can get them.
Yeah, so I'm not in Madison, so I'm not going to be much help there, and Larry might be better. But you are absolutely right, because with the, you know, it used to be farmers had straw and used it for animal bedding, and it was kind of cheap because it's the, you know, after they harvest the oats or other grains and that. But now that straw bale gardening is a big deal, the price of a bale of straw has gone up crazy. And there are a lot of garden centers that will have them. Yes, they'll be expensive. But in our area, a lot of the recommendation is looking on like Craigslist and stuff like that to see if you might be able to find something a little more economical. And Larry, since you're a straw bale gardener in that area, maybe you got some better ideas.
No, well, knowing a farmer is like I do is a good way to do it. And it's another way to think about it is the year before. The fall of the year, whenever harvest is going on, is if you know the farmers or whatever, you might be able to get them a little less expensively. So if you buy them in the fall or sometime in the summer and carry them over, you can use straw. I've used hay bales. And the difference was, well, there wasn't any difference, frankly. You can use pretty much anything. there's ways that you can make bales and so forth. But I've used hay bales the last several times because I couldn't get straw bales from the farmer that I know. So
that's a really good point, Larry. And sometimes you can find hay, especially if you go on like farm sites or horse Facebook groups. I wish you were closer because I've got a shed full of hay and I wouldn't mind parting with a few bales for your gardening purposes. But the key is just conditioning it right, you know, getting the fertilizer on and water on early enough. And hay will break down just as well as straw. People come say that, well, hay has weed seeds in it and stuff. And that's not necessarily true. It depends on when it was harvested and how that hay field was maintained. And in a straw bale garden situation, Larry,
Never had problems with weeds in the hay bales. So,
and I've seen straw bale gardens sprouting with oats because all the grain hadn't been removed. And so they're pretty easy to, whatever it is that's growing in there would be pretty easy to pull out.
A lot easier than getting on your hands and knees in the garden and pulling it that way. So Deb, check around, see if you can find some, rather than straw, look for some hay bales. And and I like your idea about going up to some of these, going online to some of the horse folks.
And, you know, an interesting thing is, for those of you who don't have horses like me, horses and all livestock, they eat more when it's cold because that's how they generate their internal heat. This winter was so easy that there are going to be a lot of people with leftover hay. So you might be able to find it at a pretty decent price because we just didn't have to feed as much to the livestock this year with it not getting so cold.
That's another very good point. Deb, thank you very much for calling and good luck getting your hands on some hay or straw bales. I hope you do. And I hope you'll come back and be with us again, Diana. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much for having me back. It's always fun and always fun to hear about what gardening questions are concerning people throughout the state. So thanks for having me.
Diana Alfeth is a retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. And as I said earlier, just because she's retired doesn't mean she's forgotten anything. She's remembered pretty darn well, and it's fun. And we'll get her back, and we'll do this all over again. Next week, Friday on Garden Talk, we'll talk with Diana's former cohort, Kevin Schesso, about starting seeds inside and take some other questions as well. And on Monday, our regular physical therapists talk about TMJ disorders and how you can treat them. That's Monday right here on WPR. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.